Available as podcasts on your favorite podcast platforms and as videos on our Let's Talk Native TV YouTube channel. Find links and more at our website, www.letstalknative.com. And I'll see you here Fridays at 2 p.m. for Let's Talk Native with John Cain.
I'm Candy Shannon, and you are tuned to member-supported WPFW Washington.
And welcome to this hour of We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone, right here at WPFW 89.3 FM, your jazz and justice station for over 47 years, because you, the listeners, support us in entirety, and we thank you for that. We the People's a weekly news magazine, and it deals with issues of race, history, politics, and culture, especially where they intersect. Many people, past and present, have done a lot of hard work so we can have a better state of well-being, of better communities. And they leave us a legacy, they point us the way forward, and often they encourage us that we are not alone in whatever struggle and striving we're doing, but that we have some encouragement, some distinct ways of doing things. To apply that to today's topic, we're going to deal with the threat of plastics. There's a tremendous growth of plastics, and it poses grave dangers to our health, well-being, and the planet. To help us understand this situation is Lisa Ramsden. Ms. Ramsden is a senior oceans campaigner at Greenpeace USA. She has worked on several campaigns in various roles for more than a decade, including the fight to keep Shell Oil from drilling in the Arctic and the ongoing struggle to keep corporations from producing single-use plastics that end up in our oceans. She has sailed on all three Greenpeace ships up and down both coasts of the United States to the Alaskan Arctic and through the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, which we'll talk about later. Good morning and welcome, Ms. Ramsden.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Oh, what a mess that we're in the world of plastics. Let me begin with an introduction. I know I'm going to cause you to bring a lot to the table, to do some heavy lifting, some pun. Here comes the pun, people, a deep dive. So let me start with the history of plastics. As people could understand it, plastics are ubiquitous presence in our daily lives. They touch every facet of our existence. Plastics, if you listen to the industry and listen carefully, are derived from natural organic materials such as cellulose, coal, natural gas, salt, and of course, crude oil. also from such things as corn, cotton, and starch. But if you caught the phrase natural organic, also know that plastics are synthetic, that they're man-made, they're man-generated, and they are with us to the tune of 9.2 billion metric tons are estimated to have been made between 1950 and 2017, and more than half of which were produced since 2004. In 2020, 400 million tons of plastic were produced. And if global trends on plastic demand continue, it's estimated by 2050, the annual global plastic production will reach over 1.1 billion tons, as it is reported by the UN Environmental Project. Ms. Ramsden, we're a stickler for history, so I'll just hurry up and finish up here. In the 19th century, as chemistry developed the Industrial Revolution, there were many new materials. So these materials included the development of plastic, and a familiar name to at least most U.S. Americans would be Charles Goodyear, whose 1839 discovery of a process called vulcanization causes natural rubber to harden. That encouraged further research, obviously. There's a substance called Parkesine, invented by Alexander Parkes in 1855 and patented the following year. It's considered to be the first man-made plastic, again, in 1855. It's manufactured basically from cellulose and nitric acid, and it was known as being pliable and moldable, and again, more encouragement of developing in plastics. The first fully synthetic plastic was called Bakelite, invented in New York in 1907 by Leo Baekeland, who coined the term plastics. And since then, many chemists have contributed to the material science of plastics, including Nobel laureates. We see a wave of the development of plastics after World War I, and mass production really picks up the steam in the 1940s and the 1950s. And you just get all sorts of, there's hundreds and hundreds of different plastics. Since I gave that history, people should know that there's 750 plus companies that make up the 75-year-old Plastic Industry Association. So that gives people some historical context. I guess I could gather from the long introduction, we've had wave after wave of plastic production, particularly from the 1950s onward. What would you have us focus on as far as understanding why we are in a crisis regarding plastics?
This crisis is multifaceted. There are so many different ways to look at it. From a very basic point of view, you can see that plastics are polluting our communities. They're polluting our coastlines, our waterways, our oceans. And that is a problem. People don't want to see trash in their communities. It's also an issue because plastics production, the production of plastic is harmful at every stage of its life cycle, when it's extracted as oil from the ground, to when it is refined in these refineries, to when it is dealt with at the end of its life, whether it's recycled or incinerated or winds up in our natural environment. It's an issue at every stage of its life cycle. There are communities who are living next to these refineries all around the Gulf Coast, largely Black and Brown communities, who are facing serious health issues because they live next to these refineries. They're basically being poisoned by these companies, all for the production of these cheap single-use plastics that we use for a few moments and then throw away. So it's an issue on many different levels.
And to make it overly abundant, what you just described is that plastic could be called a main contributor to greenhouse gases.
Absolutely.
So we've got the physicality, the tactile part of plastics, and we've got the greenhouse gas problem as well. And let's just cut to the chase. The phrase that stood out that you just said was single-use plastics. What are they, and how do they work their way into our lives?
Yeah, so single-use plastics to me are definitely the most egregious of plastics in terms of pollution. They're the items that we use for just a few minutes and then discard, whether we are attempting to recycle them or we just throw them away. But think about a plastic water bottle that you use for just a few hours, or plastic spoons and forks, styrofoam and plastic to-go containers, even a lot of food packaging that we get from the grocery store, like the clamshells that you buy your berries in or that you buy your salad greens in. These are items that we're just using very briefly and then are then thrown away and will remain in our environment in some way or another for a very, very long time.
So if people haven't gathered, we're making it clear that they're not degradable. They don't decompose. What they do is they break down into other, they break down into other molecules. They become fractions of their, or fragments of their original existence.
Exactly. Yeah.
And, well, you know, and thinking about the growth, particularly in the last few decades of the use of plastic, you know, we get pounded with messages in the public that even single use are recyclable. Can we kind of, no pun intended, break that down for a moment?
Yeah, so you talked about how plastic production has increased exponentially over the past 20 years or so. All of the plastics that have ever been created globally, of all of those plastics, only 9% of them have actually been recycled. So it's a very 9%. Small amount.
Okay.
Yeah.
And the remaining 96%, let's see if we can deal with that. Well, if we're talking about the ocean, people think of, you know, massive pieces of plastic or fairly large, visually discernible pieces of plastic. But when plastic winds up in the ocean, doesn't most of it wind up on the ocean floor?
Yeah. So when people think about the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, oftentimes people imagine this like massive floating mountain or island of trash just kind of circulating out in the ocean the size of Texas. When in reality, it's more like a plastic soup. It's a bunch of smaller particles of plastic that have broken down, because when plastic is in an environment like the ocean, the salinity from the seawater, the UV rays from the sun are breaking that plastic down. A lot of plastic products are made out of different types of plastic. So if you think about a plastic bottle, one of the first things that degrades when it's in the ocean is that cap that is attached to the plastic bottle. So when that cap comes off, the bottle fills with water and it sinks to the bottom. So you might find some bottle caps floating on top of the water, but you might not see too many whole bottles. Lots of plastics sink to the bottom. Some animals and fish will nibble on bits of plastic. So you can often find big chunks of plastic that have fish bites taken out of them in the middle of the garbage patch. And there are some larger pieces of plastic out there, but those are going to be the more durable plastics, like buckets and tubs that are made of really thick plastic. And a lot of that trash is associated with fishing, which is a pretty big source of ocean waste as well.
So if I've got it right from the research that your group has done, but others as well, about 1% of plastic is floating at the top of oceans. Another 5% is winding up on beaches. And the remaining 94% is heading toward the ocean floor. Is that right?
I think that sounds about right.
Mm-hmm. And do you want to say anything further? You've been to the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. Again, you described it as big as the size of Texas. It moves around in the Pacific, I assume, given mm-hmm. the currents. What more do you want to tell us? What did you actually see that could give our listeners either a visual picture or even a stronger impression of concern?
So the reason why the Great Pacific Garbage Patch exists out there is because of these ocean currents and ocean gyres. And a lot of the plastic that winds up there comes from land. It's from coming from rivers that flow to the ocean. So a community could be miles and miles and miles away from the ocean. But when there's a big rainstorm, some waste that is mismanaged in their community flows into the rivers, and then it washes out to the ocean, and then these currents kind of circulate it in this general area in the Great Pacific, or in the Pacific.
Yeah, we're calling it a gyre, G-Y-R-E, folks. Can you think of a giant vortex, a swirling cloud-like mass? Maybe that's a good way to put it.
Exactly. And the gyre in the Pacific isn't the only one. There are these gyres in all parts of the ocean. The Great Pacific one, the garbage patch there, is just the one that's gotten the most
notoriety.
Exactly.
Most attention.
Yeah.
Well, let's still stick with being in the ocean. This presence of plastics, I assume, also impedes, it probably raises the acidity of the ocean, but it also impedes the carbon dioxide mediating or mitigating function of the ocean. Is that correct?
Yeah, so we're still trying to figure out exactly what harm is being done to the oceans by all of this plastic being in it, but the oceans are essential for life on Earth, and the oceans absorb a ton of carbon dioxide, so they're super important in regulating the climate.
Okay, and let's backtrack. We can kind of leverage what we've been talking about. So it shows up in the food supply and fish. And as we said earlier, it is not degradable. It doesn't degrade. It merely fractures. It decomposes into fragments. Recently, a number of national papers on record, I'm thinking of the New York Times and the Washington Post, have talked about the presence of plastic particles in our environment. They were particularly concerned with air pollution, for instance. But the important thing that they pointed out pictorially is that it was a reminder that when plastics do decompose, they turn into micro and nano particles. However you want, but particularly... tell us how that's particularly dangerous to human beings and life forms.
Yeah. So I'll start with the oceans and then I'll bring it back to human beings. But we were just talking about the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, all these plastics out there, and then fish eating them and other wildlife out there eating them. And this can be harmful to a lot of this wildlife because their stomachs can fill up with plastic and then they think that they're full, so they stop eating and they essentially starve to death because they have a stomach full of plastic. We're seeing this with seabirds a lot too. It's then a concern for humans because if we are eating the fish that has been eating all of this plastic, some of the chemicals in the plastic can then be absorbed in the fish, and then we eat those chemicals when we eat the fish. There have been so many studies coming out in the past couple of years talking about the presence of microplastics in human bodies. Microplastics have been found in our blood, in placentas, in our lungs, in breast milk, in human hearts, essentially everywhere that scientists and researchers have decided to look, they've been finding microplastics. And while we don't know exactly what these microplastics are doing to us when they're in our bodies, we do know that plastics are made with more than 16,000 different chemicals, and many of these chemicals are known to be harmful to human health. They are endocrine disruptors, they are carcinogenic, they are cancer-causing. So it's pretty easy to make a correlation for why this would be concerning to us, that these plastics are winding up in our bodies.
And it's hard for the body to, or living organisms, to rid themselves of the plastic. Am I correct in that?
Yeah, it's not as simple as us just eating plastics and then, you know, disposing of them the way that we get rid of other waste in our body. These plastics are so tiny, these tiny little particles and filaments that are embedding themselves in our tissues. And I don't know if anyone has figured out a way to get rid of these from our bodies yet.
Well, I know that the U.S. Department of Energy had a estimate, I think it was for the year 2019, where in the U.S., plastic waste amounts to about 44 million metric tons. Just to give people an idea, that's about 300 or 295 pounds of plastic per person that's floating around, that's present in our environment, rather, excuse me. We've talked about the impression. Well, first, let me reintroduce you. We're talking to Lisa Ramsden. She's the senior oceans campaigner at Greenpeace USA. We're basically talking about the threat of plastics in our environment. You're listening to We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone. Importantly, you're tuned in to WPFW 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org. Again, Ms. Ramsden, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's get down to it. Does recycling work? I made the illusion that we've been massaged into believing it's so. There are probably many, many different reasons why, as we go on talking, we'll indicate that recycling doesn't work. Tell us why.
So the plastics and products industries have been promoting plastic recycling as the solution to plastic waste since the early 1990s. Many of us, millennials especially, were brought up as the generation that, you know, recycling was the way to help the environment. And the plastics industry came up with this idea to sort of shirk responsibility from themselves. They could just keep pumping out tons and tons of plastic, and it wouldn't matter what happened to it because it's the consumer's responsibility. If they don't recycle, it's on them. They even came up with the term litter bug because, again, they wanted to remove the responsibility from their products and just put that on individuals instead. So that was happening throughout the 80s and 90s, and, you know, now we're really seeing that most plastics are fundamentally not recyclable, and that this is not a way to solve this crisis. Greenpeace USA released a report almost 2 years ago that found that about 5% of plastics produced in the U.S. are actually being recycled. And that varies depending on the types of plastics. Plastics number one and twos, those are your plastic bottles, your plastic jugs. Those ones are much more recyclable. They're being recycled at rates of about 20% and 10% respectively. But as you get into plastics 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, those are rarely being recycled. Plastics number five are pretty common. Those are like yogurt tubs, a bunch of different food containers, and those are rarely recycled in the U.S. But many of us are hopeful when we finish off our yogurt tub, we put it in the recycling, and it might just wind up in a landfill or being incinerated instead.
Again, to make it clear, so 90% of plastics, 90% or more, wind up either in landfills or in incineration. They are not recycled.
Yep, that is correct.
Plus, hate to be the spoiler, but in most municipalities, those different grades of resin, those different grades of plastic, they're all mixed together. And mm-hmm. doesn't that pose a problem with the actual physical process of recycling?
Definitely. If you think about the amount of plastic each of us are bringing into our homes every day just by, you know, existing, by going to the grocery store, by getting to-go food, we bring all of that, those little pieces of plastic into our houses, and then we put them into a recycling bin that then gets collected by your municipality, if that exists where you live, and then gets shipped off to be sorted and then baled and then perhaps recycled. It's a really labor and energy intensive process. And we're producing so much of this plastic and trying to recycle so much of it that it's almost impossible to keep up with. And we're also finding that there's not a huge market for recycled plastics. Even when we do have some that is available, there aren't enough buyers for it. And one of the fundamental issues with plastics is that they are not infinitely recyclable. You can't take a plastic bottle and endlessly turn it back into another plastic bottle. It has to be what we call downcycled. So that means turning it into something of lesser quality. It gets turned into carpets or a loofah that you might use in the shower or a fleece that you might wear. So That's kind of the core issue with recycling plastic. Other products are infinitely recyclable, like glass. Cardboard and paper are really recyclable. Aluminum is super recyclable, but plastic is just a trickier substance.
And you're being kind by omission, but in the downcycling, in the recycling attempts, wouldn't the issue of toxicity also come up as well and give us a handle on that concern?
Absolutely. Thanks for mentioning that. As I mentioned, these plastics are made with more than 16,000 different chemicals, and those chemicals don't just magically vanish when we attempt to recycle them. And another concern is that we are putting all of our recyclable plastics in the same bin. So your milk jug could be in the same recycling bin as a motor oil container or a container that had pesticides. And then all of those are getting sent to the same place to then be chopped up or melted down or recycled. And there could be some residue from that motor oil container or that Drano container that then gets commingled with other plastics. A couple of years ago, the Canadian government actually said that recycled plastics are not safe for food packaging. So you can no longer take recycled plastics and then turn them into food packaging in Canada because they've deemed it unsafe.
We're coming up on the halfway point of our show, but I want to at least introduce something. I know that in the second half of the show, we're going to talk about this to some degree, but the demand for fossil fuels and particularly oil and petroleum-based things has been going down. Arguably, how much or how significant is, of course, debated by many different stakeholders. But as that trend was going on, didn't big oil, didn't they pick up that they needed to do something in terms of profitability? And I hate to even use this word in relation, pardon the prejudice, folks, but in their own sustainability. So they made a move to the plastic industry. Can you explain what that transition has meant? What does it look like?
Absolutely. So we've touched on this, but 99% of plastics are made from fossil fuels. So the same companies that are, drilling for oil and producing oil for our cars and things like that are the same companies who are producing a lot of the building blocks for these plastics that we are using in our everyday lives now. And they have made this like intentional shift to the petrochemical sector, to plastic production, because they are seeing that more and more electric cars are coming online. And as that happens, as we start to electrify our grid, the need for fossil fuels will diminish. So this is sort of the oil industry seeing the writing on the wall that perhaps they are going to be in decline. So now they're trying to put not all of their money, but a lot of their efforts into petrochemical and plastic production instead.
All right. We'll have to go shortly, but that does mean new exploration, new plants, new manufacturing, does it not?
Yeah, and there are already, I think, upwards of 200 petrochemical facilities in the Gulf South, and they are, trying to build more and more every day, it seems.
Well, listeners, you're listening to We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone, but more importantly, our guest, Lisa Ramsden, a senior oceans campaigner at Greenpeace USA, is talking to us about the threat of plastics. We're in service to you because we're a Jazz and Justice radio station supported for over 47 years by listener financial and social support. That is our reality. That is our sole and primary source of funding and existence, and dare I say, reason for being, to try to bring you Jazz and Justice, which helps us build a better world one broadcast at a time. In order to do this and to be in further service with you, we're obliged to give you public service announcements. Would you stay with us as we discuss the threat of plastics after our brief break? And we'll be right back. Please do stay with us after this. And welcome back to We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone. Our guest is Lisa Ramsden. Ms. Ramsden is a senior oceans campaigner at Greenpeace USA, we are talking about the threat of plastics. The tremendous growth of plastics pose grave dangers to our health and well-being and the planet. Again, Ms. Ramsden, thank you for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
I just wanted to make sure we covered something. We were talking about the nature of plastics. I just wanted to take a moment and acknowledge and see what you had to say about the possible biodegradability of plastics. We're noticing, especially if we succumb to something like fast food or other eating functions, that a lot of the plastics we use now are marked biodegradable. Is that effective? Is I'll just trail off here with my question.
Yeah, great question. And it's a very popular question these days, because we like to think that these biodegradable plastics are a better option for us, when in reality, they aren't. If a plastic product says it's biodegradable, it still will take a very, very long time to biodegrade. And a lot of times these plastics aren't marine degradable, so they don't just like break apart immediately in the ocean, for instance. Animals can still ingest these bits of plastic and still choke on them and have all of these negative impacts from them. There are also a lot of plastics being touted as compostable, and those plastics are only compostable at commercial composting facilities. So if you were to put that plastic compostable cup in your backyard composting bin, it likely would not biodegrade. It needs to be at a commercial composting facility, and not many municipalities offer that as an option. And I have actually heard secondhand from one of these commercial composters near where I live that they don't want to accept any more of this compostable plastic in their facility because they're kind of inundated with it now. And the great part about compost is that it turns into this like nutrient-rich material that you can be used to amend soil. And these biodegradable plastics don't add any nutritional value. They don't add any essential ingredients to a mixture of compost. So they're actually making compost worse and kind of worthless. So when we're looking at biodegradable and compostable plastics, that's just our society trying to switch from one single-use throwaway product to another single-use throwaway product. And to me, that's the wrong solution. We need to re-examine how we are consuming things in our everyday lives and switch to reusable, refillable, washable items rather than these single-use throwaway products.
And we have done that. We've existed as such.
Exactly.
Some of us are old enough to remember the big glass bottles of soda pop or other liquids that we consumed.
Exactly.
Also, I just, as an aside, enjoying the Chesapeake, whether it's the northern part or not, but if you're particularly in lower New Jersey, for instance, going down into Delaware and such, at least around some of the visiting sites that are lighthouses or marshes, I noticed some of the Park Service have put up signs, and they especially focused in on styrofoam, and the sign will have how things degrade or decompose, and it literally takes thousands of years for, and I better use the right verb here, to not degrade, but just decompose. Mm-hmm. And this is styrofoam, folks. Yeah. So it does pose grave dangers. And it's safe to say, without being snarky, that every little bit adds up. So is it unfair to say that the plastics are so abundant, I think in a matter of a few decades, their existence might triple in our world. We're just really outstripped. I mean, it's just off scale. It's out of scale. It's not gloom and doom, but the presence of plastics. Right now, we really must get serious and have some resolve and actions. Is that correct?
Absolutely. We cannot continue on the way that we are right now. We will just be inundated with plastic. And I think that we're just going to discover more and more health impacts that we are facing from plastic pollution. So we need to start dealing with it now.
All right. And we've been talking about some of the economics and politics of it. You mentioned how even in the U.S. that recycling, I think there's about 370 going on to 400 facilities spread throughout the United States, that they're turning down a lot of the volume of the plastic. And some nations in other parts of the world have had, with great courage, been turning it down as well. Do you know anything about what's going on globally that you can tell us about, please?
Yeah, so up until about 2019, we were shipping a lot of our plastic to China, and we were saying that that plastic was recycled, so we were counting it as recycled, when in reality, we don't know what was happening to it when it got to China. It could have been incinerated. It could be sitting in landfills. Maybe some of it was recycled. But this has been happening all around the globe, where wealthier nations have been exporting their plastic to other countries who may or may not have the infrastructure to deal with all of this waste. And it's created quite an issue, because we are dumping all of our plastic on these poor nations and expecting them to deal with it. And it's a huge problem and is very unfair.
And often, not all the time, but there's a convergence between the generation of plastic waste and this recycling. We mentioned China. I know Science Magazine and some others, in a pretty straightforward fashion, have talked about either waste mismanagement or waste prevalence. The countries at issue, we mentioned China, Indonesia, the Philippines, Vietnam, Sri Lanka, Thailand, Egypt, Malaysia, Nigeria, Bangladesh, South Africa, India, Algeria, Turkey, Pakistan, Brazil, Burma, Morocco, North Korea, and then at the ranking number 20, if you understood the length of that list, is the United States. The reason I mention this is to emphasize the obvious. It's indeed a global problem. People of very few means, people black and brown, are really suffering. And so we do want to paint a picture that we're all in trouble, but to have the proper empathy and compassion, let it lead us to doing something. With that being said, I think around, March 2 years ago at the United Nations, something was put on the table. That was the proposal of a global plastic treaty. And to be quite frank with you, I think it's an exciting opportunity for the world community. It's a once, almost in a lifetime, once in a generational opportunity to do something. Can you tell us some of the dynamics around the Global Plastic Treaty and what you hope to see happen?
Yeah, so the Global Plastics Treaty is a super exciting opportunity for us to combat the plastic waste crisis on a global scale. The first round of negotiations started in Uruguay, and just in April of this year, the fourth round of negotiations wrapped up in Canada. We are scheduled to have just one more session in November, and that will happen in Busan, South Korea. And hopefully by the end of that session, we will have a strong and ambitious global plastics treaty that can actually help us deal with this crisis. But we are not there yet. Negotiations are still very much ongoing, and we still have not agreed upon what exactly will be in this treaty. And that's what Greenpeace USA is, and Greenpeace globally is working on a lot right now, because we believe that if this treaty does not call for a cap on plastic production, then it might be a failure. We cannot continue producing as much plastic as we are producing with the hopes that recycling will fix it. We cannot keep producing all of this plastic and then keep just doing beach cleanups and hoping that we can go clean up the middle of the ocean. We have to stop producing so much plastic in the first place, because we simply cannot deal with all of this plastic waste. So this is what we really need this treaty to focus on. The U.S. position, so the U.S. is a huge player in this Global Plastics Treaty, because of the power that this nation holds. And right now, the negotiators for the U.S. are not in support of a cap on plastic production. And this is really what Greenpeace is trying to focus on right now. And what we're trying to urge them to do is to call for a reduction in plastic production. But there's a very powerful plastics industry lobby out there who sees this as hurting their profits. And so they are also lobbying these negotiators really hard. It was fascinating to be up in Canada for the last round of negotiations, where the industry sunk a lot of money into advertisements. They took out advertisements in the airport, in a hotel that was right next to the convention center. They had a billboard truck that was driving around, and they had a few different messages that they were touting, but one of them said, "These plastics save lives." And it was a person with a ventilator mask on. And another one said, like, "These plastics deliver fresh water." And it was a person seemingly in an underdeveloped country with a plastic bottle of water. So they're trying to tout the uses of plastics. And, you know, we could talk about the great uses of plastics because they are helpful in medical settings and things like that. But what we're really focused on are these single-use plastics that are absolutely unnecessary. And that's what we feel like this global plastics treaty could really help regulate.
You know, it's not often to get into micro-focus with the problems, but I want to take advantage of the examples you just mentioned and the messaging around them. First, sometimes people are compelled by emotional response as well as facts. So how is it, what is the logic of extending? I mean, for instance, we've been through a pandemic. You know, we had masks that had plastic components. You talked about the person who needed water delivered in a situation of water scarcity. How is there any extrapolation? How is there any extension to say we must produce plastics by and large in mass on wholesale when we have these very specific functions?
Yeah, it's you know, they're trying to pull on heartstrings and make the argument that, like, all plastics are necessary.
So does anybody break down the percentage? It must be imaginably a very small.
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not
in
sure.
In a larger frame.
Yeah.
And you probably in your answer anticipated those of us who are not internationalists or globalists, the cynical assumption and projection that these international treaties do nothing because they're not implemented or truly enforced. Are there any particularly different dynamics? You know, we've got global warming, poverty, income disparities, but again, not where does the plastics situation fit in negotiation? What, tell us some more about the particulars.
Yeah, so the other important part of this treaty is that we need it to be legally binding. We need countries to be held accountable for the amount of plastic waste that they're producing and what they do with it. And one of the biggest parts of that is making sure that the corporations who are producing all of this plastic are responsible for the plastic that they're producing. Just to give folks an example, Coca-Cola, just one big company, but Coca-Cola on average is producing 125 billion single-use plastic bottles every year.
125 billion?
A year.
Okay.
Yeah, it's an astronomical amount, and they're just one company. They absolutely have to be held accountable for that because they are just putting all of this plastic out into the world and then expecting people to deal with it. And they're expecting municipalities to be able to recycle all of this. And we just can't. It's way too much waste. So a big part of this plastics treaty would mandate you know, different ways that these companies would be held accountable. And to bring it back to a more domestic example, not sure if you saw, but just last week, the mayor of Baltimore actually filed a lawsuit against Coca-Cola and PepsiCo and a few other companies for the amount of plastic that they are forcing upon the city of Baltimore. And this is a trend that we're seeing happening more and more in the US. And I hope that it continues because it's necessary. But
is that one of the earliest cases? Has there been any resolve with any similar actions, or is this a new frontier, so to speak?
Yeah, I think it's a new frontier. Last year, an attorney general in New York filed a similar lawsuit against PepsiCo. So we're hoping to see more of this because I think people are just realizing that they're just producing too much plastic. We can't continue to clean up after them.
Well, I'm either reintroduce you here on We the People, right here at WPFW 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org. is Lisa Ramsden. Ms. Ramsden is a senior oceans campaigner at Greenpeace USA. And the topic today on We the People is the threat of plastics. The tremendous growth of plastics pose indeed grave dangers to our health and well-being, as well as the planet. And so we're here to discuss that. Can you give people a reiteration of understanding how, as many large social problems are, the cost of plastics is really put upon us as individuals and not taken up by corporations? It seems to me the insinuation here is that there has to be a political, social, and moral lever to get full responsibility on the part of plastic producers.
Yeah, we can all play a small part in tackling this problem. It's important to minimize as much plastic in your everyday life as you can. But we have to move beyond, rejecting plastic straws and bringing our own bags to the grocery store. Like, those are great steps, but we have to do more. But it's hard to do more. You go to the grocery store and everything is packaged in plastic. It's impossible to buy some fruits and vegetables unless you buy them wrapped in plastic. And this is why we need to work with corporations. We need to work with retailers like these grocery stores and look for package-free solutions. And we need the government to regulate this, because otherwise they will just continue to package everything in plastic. And then it makes it really hard for us to avoid this in our everyday lives.
Can you point to some circumstances, some situation, possibly some community that has been somewhat successful or has made progress?
That is a good question. There are, several cities that passed plastic bag bans, straw bans. There are some communities that have banned styrofoam, that have banned to-go, like styrofoam to-go containers and things like that. We need more cities and towns to be active and do things like this. I can't think of a singular city that has gone plastic free. I feel like some cities are moving in the right direction, but we definitely need more of this.
And a deliberate contrast, I mentioned earlier, I can't find the right phrase, but the tremendous presence in the two-thirds world of plastics. Often when I've read articles, places in the Middle East are inundated with single use. And obviously in times of war and an oppression that, for instance, the mere deliverance of water and food would lend itself to this. What's the pushback, fight back, or just some other decent way of living without plastic that's going on in other parts of the world?
Yeah. There are different ways to get water to people. There are reusable, refillable containers. That's a pretty straightforward one.
Frankly, in those places that are disadvantaged, with no condescension, they do actually do what you're saying.
Exactly. Yeah. I have some colleagues who work in the Philippines, and they are fighting plastic sachets, which are these like flexible plastic packages. Kind of think about like your ketchup and mayo packets. But in the Philippines, they're sold in these sari-sari stores as single-use servings of like shampoo and conditioner. And they are sold in these individual servings because they're said to be cheaper. You know, you don't need as much money to buy just a serving or two as a whole big bottle. But it's actually a disservice to those communities, because if they were to buy the entire bottle, it would be cheaper overall than buying these packets. And these sachets are a new thing in these sari-sari stores. You used to be able to bring your own jar or container from home and get your conditioner, your shampoo, your cooking oil, and all of these things in your own containers, and it would be more affordable. And then these communities wouldn't have to deal with these plastic sachets polluting their waterways and their communities, because those are completely unrecyclable. So, you know, we need to move back to these systems of refill and reuse, and move away from these single-use throwaway packaging solutions that are not solutions.
That could be a final word for us in this hour, but I'm going to do something very deliberate. We've got about 2 minutes on the clock, and I've tried my best to be very thorough in questions and comments, but I want to give you an opportunity of just making any sort of statement, anything that we've overlooked regarding plastics in our world.
Yeah, you've been extremely thorough. Thanks for asking all of these great questions. I just want to reiterate that, again, plastics are polluting at every stage of their life cycle, and they are causing, like, the production of plastics are causing real harm to communities in the U.S., in the Gulf South, and these are often disenfranchised communities, and a lot of these people are living in what we call Cancer Alley. They have been dealing with so many industries moving in there and taking advantage of them for so long, and no one should have to suffer these sorts of health consequences so that we can have the convenience of a bottle of Coca-Cola. It's just unfair and unjust and not worth it, which is why we need to start holding these corporations accountable. And we need our government to get on board with reducing the amount of plastic that we are creating. We need the Biden administration to support a strong global plastics treaty. We need to do this sooner than later, before we have an even bigger mess to clean up and before we discover even worse health impacts from the microplastics that we're finding in our bodies.
Well, I thank you again. Thank you, Lisa Ramsden. Lisa Ramsden is a senior oceans campaigner at Greenpeace USA. And we've been talking about the threat of plastics right here on We the People, right here on WPFW 89.3 FM, your Pacifica station coming from Washington, D.C. My thanks to Mike Nasella, our engineer, to the News and Public Affairs Department of WPFW, to the fellow programmers that make all our programming happen. There are about 80-plus different programmers that bring you a grid of both jazz and justice. Coming up later today at 3 to 5, Sophie's Parlor, music and culture by women but for everyone. At 2 p.m., Shewanana with Zen El Amin, obviously talking about the current affairs of the Middle East and then some. And at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, Africa Now is broadcast with host and producer Muiza Mutale, referencing those things of people of African descent, not only in the continent, but throughout the diaspora. And at every new time hour during the week, we don't forget the blues, the Wednesday editions with Clarence the Bluesman Turner. All that is offered to you with our great thanks, because you, the listener, again, have supported us for more than 47 years. And I, for one, join others in thanking you. Ms. Ramsden, again, thank you for being with us in this hour. And folks, coming up next from this point forward, 5 minutes before the hour, is the news. I believe either Chris Banger Drowns or Sue Goodwin will bring that to you. Thank you for being with us. Be well and take care. Thanks again.
Born in 1899, Edward Kennedy Ellington ranks as the greatest all-around musical figure. This Thursday, July 11th, from midnight until midnight, WPFW honors Ellington on the occasion of his 125th birth year with Ellington 125, a celebration beyond category. Hi, this is Miyuki. WPFW must move, so we will be raising funds toward that end. Our goal is $15,000, and there are Ellington 125 commemorative gifts available as a thank you gift for your support. You can donate now or anytime on our website. For those that contribute to our relocation fund and are able to donate $125 or more, a special commemorative 125 Ellington thank you gift is described on our website. Help WPFW build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
No social justice issue or movement can escape the spotlight of the Latino Media Collective. The Latino Media Collective delivers consequential coverage from the biggest countries in South America to the smallest enclaves of Central America and the Caribbean, and is available on SoundCloud, iTunes Podcast, and Google Play Music. The Latino Media Collective is recorded in WPFW Studios and airs Fridays at 1 p.m. on WPFW Washington.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Christina Onnested. Israeli airstrikes killed 20 Palestinians in central Gaza, including 6 children and 3 women, some of them inside an Israeli-declared safe zone today. The strikes come as U.S., Egyptian, Qatari, and Israeli officials gather in Doha for ceasefire and hostage release talks. Meanwhile, a panel of United Nations experts say famine has spread across the Gaza Strip and are accusing Israel of carrying out a targeted starvation campaign. Tariq Jasarevic is a spokesperson for the WHO, World Health Organization.
34 people have died of malnutrition and dehydration so far. And then the Kamal Adwan Hospital alone, 60 cases of severe acute malnutrition were detected last week.
He warns malnutrition weakens the immune system, as destroyed sanitation infrastructure in Gaza has led to the spread of disease. This as Israel ramps up strikes in Gaza, bombing 4 United Nations-run schools in the last 4 days, killing dozens of Palestinians, mostly women and children, according to eyewitnesses. The latest strikes Tuesday killed 31 Palestinians near Khan Yunis and wounded some 50 others. It was condemned by the United Nations. In the U.S., President Joe Biden's welcomed heads of state from dozens of European nations for NATO's 75th anniversary in Washington, D.C. Christopher Martinez reports.
President Joe Biden praised NATO as the single greatest defensive alliance in the world, crediting it with preventing war, protecting democracy, and defending against aggression. And he boasted of a growing NATO, with Finland and Sweden joining, and more member nations increasing their military spending.
It's good that we're stronger than ever, because this moment in history calls for our collective strength. Autocrats want to overturn global order, which is by and large kept for nearly 80 years and counting. Terrorist groups continue to plot evil schemes to cause mayhem and chaos and suffering.
In particular, Biden praised NATO for rising to the defense of Ukraine against the Russian invasion. NATO critics from around the world gathered in Washington, D.C. for a 2-day summit called No to NATO, Yes to Peace. Sheen Kim is with the Democratic Socialists of America's International Committee.
So the heads of state of 32 NATO countries are coming to Washington, D.C., to tell us about the warmongering that they're going to be doing in the next years. And we are here to say no.
Speakers blasted NATO for military interventions in Yugoslavia, Libya, and Afghanistan, and for what they describe as escalating the war in Ukraine. I'm Christopher Martinez.
Democrats say they'll bring up legislation to counter the recent Supreme Court ruling granting presidents broad immunity from prosecution. Catherine Carley reports.
We're doing this because we believe that in America, no president should be free to overturn an election against the will of the people. no matter what the conservative justices may believe.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer says Democrats will introduce a bill to classify former President Donald Trump's efforts to subvert the 2020 election as unofficial acts. The move would strip Trump of criminal immunity the Supreme Court just granted to presidents. The White House says it's also considering how to respond to the court's unprecedented ruling. Meanwhile, Rhode Island Democratic Senator Sheldon Whitehouse is asking the Justice Department to appoint a special counsel to investigate Justice Clarence Thomas. Whitehouse says Thomas may have violated federal tax or ethics laws when he accepted luxury gifts from Republican megadonors.
If a justice isn't reporting income on his legally required financial disclosure, there's a good chance that something is amiss with his tax reporting as well.
He also wants the DOJ to investigate a $300,000 loan to Thomas that was forgiven. I'm Catherine Carley for